Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. Aris Janigian is a second-generation Armenian-American. He was born in Fresno, California. He lives in Los Angeles now with his family, but returns to the Fresno area annually to work as a grape packer and shipper. Aris is the author of two novels, Bloodvine and its sequel, River Big, which he will be discussing tonight. River Big, a story of love and betrayal, is set in an Armenian family in California's Central Valley. It's grounded in the rhythms and the complexities of farming, in the sounds of crows flapping out of plum orchards, in struggles between brothers, neighbors, and in what we inherit from the past. It is a beautiful, beautiful book. In addition to his novels, Janigian also co-authored, along with April Greiman, Something from Nothing, a book on the philosophy of design. He has a doctorate in philosophy and taught for many years at SciArc here downtown. He is the recipient of the Nakhiad Literary Award from Columbia University. I'm very proud to have him here for the first time. Rick Wortsman is director of the Drucker Institute at Claremont Graduate University, an Irvine Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation, and a columnist for Businessweek magazine. Previously, he spent two decades as a reporter and editor at the Wall Street Journal and the LA Times. He's the co-editor with Mark Erics of The King of California, J.G. Boswell, and the Making of a Secret American Empire, and Obscene in the Extreme, The Burning and Banning of the Grapes of Wrath, which he discussed at Allowed just over a year ago. Very happy to have Rick back with us tonight. Please join me in welcoming both Aris Janigian and Rick Wortsman to the LA Public Library. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you all for coming out. It's great to see you. Aris, why don't I begin, I guess, for those who may not have had a chance yet to read your novel, just with a little synopsis of River Big, the basic plot line, right? This story picks up where your first novel, Bloodvine, left off. And so why don't you just sketch out what's happened to the protagonist, Andy Demirjian, and this fight that he's had with his brother Abe, and just set the stage that'll kind of propel the discussion forward here.
Thanks to the LA Public Library and Louise Steinman for inviting me out tonight. River Big is follows the plot line of Bloodvine, my first novel. And in that novel, Andy Demirjian and his brother Abe are caught in a kind of war of words at first, and then a war over work, and finally a war over the land itself. That book ends with irreconcilable breach between the two brothers, and River Big picks up with Andy broke, financially busted emotionally, and working very hard to try to put himself together. He reflects a bit upon his past, the torment of the last few years before he pitches himself headlong into another world, trying to resurrect in some measure life for himself. And that's the start of the book, and of course I won't tell you the rest of it, but it's about the travails and adversities that he overcomes in making himself into an American.
Yeah, and this fight that you talk about, I mean, this is ugly stuff. This is why I guess brothers shouldn't go into business together, right? So this is a tomato deal gone bad, and Abe literally chasing him off the family farm with a shotgun, right? I mean, this is just to again, for those of you who haven't read it, this is pretty tense, bitter stuff.
Yeah, Andy and Abe are in financial trouble. They decide that the only way for them to get things square, make things square, is to get a loan from the government. Abe was a GI. They take that money from the loan and try for, as many farmers do, to go south and try their hands at farming tomatoes in a patch of dirt in Paris, California. And once a huge windstorm shows up and knocks the fruit down, leaving them without much, then accusations between them. And culminates with Abe saying, "You have no place here anymore." I mean, the place being the land that they had inherited from their father.
One of the things that I love about both books is there's such a real, honest sense of the soil in there, and you know, this clearly these words come from somebody who's you know, had a little dirt under his own nails. I mean, that's really clear. A little mud on his own shoes. And Louise mentioned, talk a little bit about, you know, how you are still tied up in the land. I think it's interesting, right? Still doing some great work up in Fresno and so on. Tell us about that.
Yeah, after my father died, I took over his business, which was, I guess he handled, packed and shipped wine grapes for home winemakers. It's a very kind of boutique-y industry within the wine grape industry. I simply buy blocks of grapes, 20, 40, 100 acres, and put all that fruit, amounting somewhere between, you know, 20 and 100 tons of it, into 36-pound boxes. And then we take those fruit and we ship them off to Canada, mostly to people who make their own wine. Either crush it with their feet or use a little machine, and they ferment it, and then they have little competitions where they, you know, who can outdo who in winemaking.
And you're out there working with, right? I mean, helping to direct the labor crews and hiring the crews.
Yeah.
And I mean, I've seen you. Aris and I are friends, and I've seen him coming back from Fresno after, you know, the season, and you look like, you know, just wiped out.
It's pretty wiped out.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's long hours. I have to leave my family, my two daughters and wife, to go for about a month and a half. And it's, you know, long hours, sometimes 5 to 5. And anybody who's been to Fresno, the valley at that time, knows that the heat is ungodly. And it's dust and it's heat and it's many miles and it's mostly done in a language that I don't know very well, Spanish or sometimes an Indian dialect with the Oaxacans. And we're just moving a lot of fruit around at a very swift pace. And to get that all done and to make it right for the consumer, which is increasingly difficult, demanding, you know, it takes a lot of work.
Yeah, and again, it's one of the great things about the book, I think, is not just the intimate knowledge that you have of the land, but the whole business, you know, from the financier to the laborers doing the picking to the packing house and of course, you know, the ultimate kind of variable and the vicissitudes of weather. And so all that plays in here. And I'd love for you to read a scene now where Andy, who is so desperate now, having been thrown off the farm by Abe, he's desperate to find work for support his young family. And so he's just bought this patch of dirt from the widow of an old farmer named Chimichian, who'd basically given up and let his own land go to rot years before. So pick it up at the bottom of page 56. Andy's getting ready to settle in and start farming again for the first time in a pretty long while.
He reached Chimichian's farm, pulled onto the dirt road, and puttered the truck past the house back to the shed. The sun was starting to peek over the mountains, and he sat there for a spell, watching it, feeling anxious. Maybe about the 1,000 things that could go wrong before he'd even driven down the first stake. Or maybe, just maybe, it wasn't panic, but excitement at the prospect of having a piece of dirt other than his backyard garden to work for the first time in 5 years. He doubted a soul had stepped into that shed since old man Chimichian had died, and so he walked open the big double doors reverently. Straight ahead, he made out the 47 and 52 John Deeres. He flipped on the overhead light. to the tractor's right, a forklift and two Gustafson rigs. And on the other side and against the wall, Chimicha had leaned his ladders, buckets stacked next to them. All told, the shed was clean and well organized as a dentist's tray. Andy approached the tractors, feeling a little shy for disturbing their slumber, but nonetheless settled right into the seat of the 52 and leaned over to pat it on the hood like it was a horse whose confidence he hoped to win. When he turned the key over, the tractor drowsily coughed before it opened into a basso, the sound knock-knocking against the wooden barn, holy as some church organ. He let it limber up until he could smell the diesel exhaust, and then he jiggled it into low gear and nudged it out into the first light of day. There was a big onion-skin moon sitting waist-high on the horizon. He steered the deer toward it. After a few minutes on the tractor, his body settled in and he understood that what he'd earlier felt was neither panic nor excitement, but rather worry that once he'd stepped back into farming, he'd be thrown back into the sinkhole of loss that he struggled so hard to climb out of. Like a ball player might initially feel stepping back onto the field after a hideous injury, excitement and worry all wrapped into one. He maneuvered the tractor, focusing his attention on the uprooted trees, the mess of work he had in front of him, the leaves, the fruit, and the seeds, the bark of the trees. All of it had disintegrated into the earth, leaving only bare trunks. After an hour on the tractor, he counted close to 50 trees still on the ground. He hopped off the tractor, pulled his gloves on, grabbed a large branch, and rocked one of the Santa Rosas back and forth until he heaved it over. On the rotting underside were beetles and spiders and maggots and worms, turning the tree to mulch. Thinking of the money he would save on fertilizer gave him a boost. A little after noon, he pulled out Chimichin's chainsaw and went at the trees with a vengeance. They were just wood now, something to be cut up and gotten out of the way. Only the mulch they provided for the new planting counted for anything.
It's beautiful. That's great stuff. Huh. And that mulch counting for something, the only thing that counts, right, is...
Yeah. Part of this, you know, the metaphor there, I think... You know, writers often don't know why they're writing something until someone points it out to them or until they're, you know, well into the book and can have enough distance to turn back and find out for themselves. But I think that counts for something, that Andy is, the trees belong to this old Armenian man who tore them out in a streak of impatience with the market after having lovingly tended them for most of his life. He had planted them from scratch. And they represent part of the old order that this man turned against eventually, Chimichin did. And so what Andy's left with is what's left. And I think part of the metaphor there is that the mulch, that which fertilizes the birth of something new, is what he's most matters to him right now, and not so much what had happened before.
Interesting. Yeah, we'll come back to some of that of sort of past and trying to get past the past.
Yes.
In the story, Andy gets caught up with some drug runners who he doesn't realize are drug runners at first who. Are surreptitiously growing a bunch of pot in the middle of a giant cornfield that he's also tending. This is his other job. He's got the Chimichin land, and then he's got this other deal going. How much of that is based on real events? Because I know this book takes place in the mid '60s, right? And Fresno, where this is all set, was a pretty wild town then, a real drug transshipment point between L.A. and San Francisco. And some of the novels set in a bar, which your cousin Mark's family, Mark Arax, who was a co-author of my first book, his family ran a bar where his dad was murdered, not too long after that. So how much of this is based on real stuff, including even the tussle between the brothers?
Yeah, Bloodvine was a book of half fiction, half storytelling, or maybe whole storytelling, half fiction, half fact. I had a few facts from my father in hand, and then began to flesh it out in the course of writing the book. River Big is a book of pure imagination, though some of the things, it is true that I borrow from some things that I know that happened and try to bring them into the story. And one of those is the Andy's good friend in the Sammy. Andy's good friend is the bar owner, and they are the folks that are planting the crop, you know, are harvesting it and then peddling it in his bar. And that was the case with my cousin Mark. My father and his father were very close and cousins. And so when I was writing the novel, Sammy was a friend of a bar owner and a friend of Andy in Bloodvine. So he wasn't a new character on the scene. So I thought it'd be nice to keep, you know, there's always should be a bar in every local story, you know, because it becomes the place where all the everything works its way out, a very convenient place. And so I thought to keep that relationship going, and then I thought, well, you know, maybe I can borrow a little bit from Mark's story, from his dad's story, and run, you know, make him an Armenian and make the drugs running through this place. But there were a lot of differences, obviously. Mark's father was murdered in the story and in real life, and Sammy is not, and they're not cousins, and they're friends and not cousins. So there's a little borrowing, but, you know, enough difference, I think, to settle Mark's nerves when I asked him if it was okay with him.
And how about the basic, you know, again, the sort of the events that propel everything? What is this fight between siblings? Does that come out of something real? I think it
does,
right?
Yeah,
can you talk
the
about
fact
that?
The fact part of Bloodvine was that my father indeed did have this this falling out with his brother, very nearly as I write it in the book that I know of. I did interview relatives and interviewed some friends to see how they understood the story, and then I took it and you know, did what I had to do to craft it into a story. It was the good thing about River Big is I was not burdened by facts, and that because one thinks that it's so much easier if you have some facts to work with, and then just kind of, you know, you could just paste them together and then there's the book. But actually, it's not the case. There's a tremendous burden in doing justice to facts. And then the deeper you dig into the facts, the more you realize that no one has the same story. So you can never make anybody happy. So if you're writing a book of pure imagination, then the only person you have to make happy is yourself, really. Or, you know, obviously you have to make your reader happy. But you know, at least you don't have the obligation of meeting the criterion of someone's own, you know, reading of that history.
Was that complicated family-wise in the first novel and even as it carried over to the second one, dredging up this you know, bitter incident between brothers and
I think the whole idea of dredging up things is bitter. I don't mean that to be funny, though it is kind of funny. But I think it is the writer's the you know, it's the grist of a novel is dredging things up that no one really cares to look at or see or talk about. Of course, doing it as part of your family history is even more complicated and more difficult. I got some flack. People were not happy. Most people thought it was, you know, this way or that. But I think that it was a story that needed to be told. And it was a story I needed to tell. And so, you know, I mean, if I was worried about what people thought, I wouldn't be a writer for sure.
That is for sure. Let's talk a little bit about Andy himself. I really like him as a character, Frank is one of my favorite sort of guy characters I can think of, because he's really thoughtful, he's pensive, he's almost philosophical at times, but in a real believable way. You know, not at a level where I think, boy, that's admirable, but no one would ever really think that or say that or react that way. He's very sweet, but he doesn't always do the right thing.
Yeah.
So I wondered, is there a literary inspiration for him? How autobiographical do you think Andy is? You know, how much is he you?
Mm-hmm. Well, American fiction is full of very smart alecky people, very brainy types that have really wise things to say and make us all look stupid, you know. We kind of gaze at them and think, wow, if only I could be that smart. And, you know, the kind of personification of that, literary personification, is Herzog or, you know, one of Bellow's characters. In a lot of times, fiction turns around articulate people. You have to have them to power a, you know, narrative. But it very much less frequently do you find someone who's, you know, a dirt farmer, you know, who has thoughts that are worth listening to. It's people shy away from those type of characters, mostly because they will find a hard time making it believable. But it was really based upon the temperament of my father. He was very much that kind of person. My brother's a pretty smart guy, and, you know, I'm fairly well educated. And my dad would always stun us with the things he had to say and the observations he would make. And it was almost all rooted. He was a college graduate, but it was almost all rooted from a deep, deep kind of relationship he had with the soil and the land.
Wow.
I mean, he would observe things coming from nothing. And he was the first person to grow the seedless watermelon in America. I think he was the very first, if not one of the first. And I remember he brought home one day. We got in the mail this package. It was a canister about this big, like a Coke can canister, with Japanese writing on it. And I said, "Dad, what the hell is this thing? It's all the way from Japan." He says, "You know what that is?" I said, "No, well, tell me what that is. You want me to tell you what that is? If I tell you, you won't believe me." "No, go ahead, Dad. Tell me what it is." "Well, you won't believe me if I tell you. Tell me what the damn thing is." He said, "That, son, is the seed for a seedless watermelon." I burst out laughing. No one had ever seen it. No one had ever thought of it. How ridiculous an idea. How can you make something seedless with a seed? It was like, you know, the analogy is pretty obvious. I won't even bear to mention it. But he watched this thing grow, and at every step he would take me out there to show me what was happening. And the metaphor, you know, of raising something like that, all of the implications of raising something like that, none of it slipped by him. And he was very tuned. He'd sit and he'd look up like this, and he'd look at something in the sky, and he said, "It's going to rain in about 3 weeks. I could feel it in my skin. It was dry as dust." So he had that. He had that. And part of what I want to do is to tell people that there are thinking, feeling people other than those born in Manhattan and who attend Ivy League schools. It's very hard to get people interested in those kind of characters because they usually don't reflect the people who read, nor the people who critique, nor the university professors who teach. So you're kind of at a major disadvantage by writing about these kind of people. But these kind of people populate this country far and wide. Yeah, we got a lot of dumbos here, but there are a lot of people stuck into professions that, you know, given another opportunity, another world, they wouldn't be in. So this is kind of in honor of all those types of people. And maybe I am one of those, to answer it.
That's great. Let's just, again, to give people a flavor who haven't read, I'd like you to read it. Just this, I think, is a beautiful passage where Andy is thinking about his brother Abe, the old homestead that Abe has banished him from. You can pick up, I think it's on the bottom of 26. There's a really, get in his head a little bit here.
Okay. This is Andy approaching, well, thinking about both approaching in his mind and then physically approaching the farm that he was booted off of. Andy was born on that farm, raised on it. Except for 4 years of college, he'd lived nowhere else. He knew it better than he knew just about anything, better for sure than he knew his brother, and far better, as it turned out, than he knew himself. "You have no place here," his brother said. Exactly what the Turks told the Armenians, told to a people who'd had a place there for over 2,500 years, more than a millennium before a Turk had ever set eyes on those legendary mountains. "You have no place here." Exactly what the Turks told the Armenians about fields that they had cultivated for generations on end. "Leave this place," they said. "It is ours now." "But who will care for my vines?" "We will tear them from the ground. And our hotchkars, our thousand-year-old crosses carved into a single slab of stone. The sand will bury them as time will bury you. Who will bring flowers to this ancient grave? We will use the headstones to pave your way to your heaven. And our books, we will erase them, like you, from the face of the earth. Our tongue, imagine a fallen leaf." In the first few months after Abe ran him off the farm, Andy now again drive by it, strangely stoking the pain in order to clear the air of his immobilizing confusion. On the far side of the acreage, he'd cut the engine and studied the very spot where Abe had pulled the shotgun on him. He'd live it over, add or subtract a scene, edit Abe's words or splice in a few of his own. He'd wondered if he'd done right by running away. He might have charged Abe, forced him to pull the trigger. He might have barreled through the gunshot, taking with him to the grave whatever portion of Abe's flesh he could. Cruel that the house, the barn, the fence was all there, the same as it was the day he'd had to leave it all behind. It was as if the universe had failed to register the breach, as though God were telling Andy that he must move on and wait for justice to be served in another place, in a more damning, otherworldly way. Then, about 4 months after Abe had leveled that shotgun at him, Andy got a call from one of his sisters. It was a Saturday afternoon, and he'd just returned from a haul of lettuce to Los Angeles. Abe was in the mental hospital, she told him. She didn't know much beyond that. Andy sat on the news for a week. It occurred to him, of course, that Abe's nervous breakdown, as his sister had called it, was the moral payback Andy had been looking for. He was satisfied to finally know that a part of Abe's brain, the sane part, the part he had loved and that loved him and he had loved in return, was revolting in protest to the point of splitting his being in two. But another part of him, bigger still, hoped that Abe wasn't beyond being brought back to wholeness, for Abe and for their brotherhood. He went to see his brother with that hope. In a padded room with chicken wire windows, he found Abe sitting in a corner, his body half in shadow and half bathed in warm light. They sat across from one another and talked, not quite like the old days, but pleasantly enough, absent any malice and conceit. In the end, they agreed to repair what had been sundered, once Abe got out, that is. But the minute he got out, he walked straight back into his wife's lair, and their promise to make things right evaporated.
We could hear in that last reading that the Armenian-American experienced this, the looming background of the Armenian genocide at the hand of the Turks. It's obviously central to River Big. Tell me a bit about your own family story in that context and when they immigrated and how much your own upbringing was shaped by the specter of the genocide.
Well, my mom's The most dramatic story on my mom's side is probably my grandmother, Valentine's. She was bought or purchased or taken by a Turkish military officer. It was not uncommon. It was very frequently Armenians were sold off to Kurds or Turks. Or if you were an officer, you just got one. They were either sold into harems or house slaves or converted to Islam and just absorbed into families. Valentine was taken by a man, and this man apparently loved her or fell in love with her. She was a very strikingly pretty woman. They lived together and had a child. And her brother, who had survived, probably he was in the Armenian military, probably fighting with the Russians. Or maybe he was a Turkish soldier that escaped. Her brother had escaped to Egypt and finally found where she was and got a message to her that he had made his way to Egypt and that she should come. She had a child with this Turk, and had to make a choice, a Sophie's choice, really. So she decided that she would leave, so she got on a boat with the child and crossed the Mediterranean. But the child died on the seas, and she was forced to throw it overboard in a kind of, burial at sea. And so she arrived in Alexandria, and her brother was there, and got married a second time to a man much her senior. And from that family came my mom and three other siblings. That story is in Bloodvine, retold in Bloodvine. Valentine is a character in both books, a very interesting lady, a survivor, a lover of life, as my grandma was. A real character, grown up from those circumstances. On my dad's side, probably the most dramatic story is my grandpa's, and he was his father was killed in the first wave of massacres, 1896, and after many many years, he exacted revenge on the Turkish officials whom he thought responsible. And assassinated them. How many, I don't know, but apparently quite a few. When he was identified as the assassin, he was. They came after him. He had to flee on a moment's notice, and leaving his family behind. He had three children and a wife and everybody else. He fled to Bulgaria. And then the deportations began. So his entire family was killed, and he eventually made his way to America. And then he worked in the coal mines, I think it was in Kentucky or Virginia, and eventually made his way to the new land, Fresno. And that's, that's my background. That's the stories that I carry with me, as many Armenians do, as almost all of us do, actually. And this... I guess the second part of the question is, how has that affected me? To be honest with you, I think it's affected me so deeply, it's not even identifiable. It's like, part of, I'm trained in cognitive psychology, and one of the things we learn in understanding how the mind grows and comes into being is it does by absorbing narratives, absorbing stories. And of course, that's why we tell our kids stories, and that's why stories are so important to tell our kids, and stories we tell them, and not stories that, even Sesame Street tells them. Because that's the early stuff that forms the stuff of the brain. So I think it is a very, very deeply part of me. Why I write about it is really a riddle. Because it's hard to write about, it's painful to write about, People usually don't like to read things like that. It's not entertainment exactly. It's not history exactly. It's somewhere in the middle. So, you know, I think you're compelled to write because you're exercising some ghosts. You're wanting to have a conversation with the ghosts, you know, because they seem more interesting to you than just about anything. Well, it is a very interesting generation, you know, that survived.
I want to talk about those generations a little bit. There's a particularly dramatic and gruesome scene in the book where Yervant, Andy's father, is back in the old country as a young boy. Yervant's own father had disappeared. Finally, there's this knock at the door, and Yervant runs to get it and finds a sack of body parts. Right, the Turks have butchered his father. And Andy's told this shocking story about his dad by a man named Samuelian, one of the old timers in the community in Fresno, who goes on to say, this is what you write in the novel, "They tell us, let it go. We will never let it go. For 10 million years after time has ended, we will remember." And then you write, "Samuelian wanted to pass the burden to Andy, to his entire generation, to make life heavier, to alleviate their own pain by elevating that of others, by forming a pact with the next generation, an unbroken chain of pain, like clouds need each other, need to gather for a storm." Do you feel that burden? Like you're somehow called to carry on this chain of pain? And obviously this is a huge theme in the book. Is this right? Is this fair? You know, is it fair to, you know, in the book to Andy's generation, which had been your dad's generation? Is that?
It's a deep question. It's a question I think that I can't answer without getting somebody mad. Because on the one hand, you know, I think the book wants to ask the question. It's not the first time it's being asked. I mean, Armenians, you know, very quietly ask themselves, have we done enough of this yet? I have conversations with friends and we're wondering if we can, you know, get behind Armenian things other than April 24th. Get behind Armenian artists and authors and look into other aspects of our identity, or maybe just move beyond it to a degree. So it's not the first, I'm not the first person to ask it. I may be the first person to put it in this form in fiction, though. I think that it's a question that's worth asking. I guess I would answer it that way. It's a question worth asking. It's a question worth pondering. What is the weight of history? How much does this history serve life? Or let's just say the life pulse, life itself. Because once it stops serving life, then it becomes morbid and it becomes something that diseases the body. And that's a question maybe that we answer at a personal level, not just in terms of a genocide, but in terms of anything that eats away at us, you know, anything that's happened. We all know the struggle of being violated. And, of course, the Armenia situation is just a larger scale metaphor for a much smaller scale indignities that we all face. And that's why it's such an important thing to talk about. And so, you know, we have to struggle with that question. And Andy is struggling with it in the book, right? The question isn't resolved or answered. It is grappled with. And it's a question that oftentimes we don't want to grapple with because we feel that we're betraying our people, we're betraying our identity, we're betraying something by allowing ourselves to have a conversation with it. So we become very militant and, I mean, in the worst case, we begin to fetishize our own pain. But that is done at an individual level. It also, of course, individuals, you know, can come together and multiply it, you know, in gatherings like that. But I think the question is just, for me, is just asking the question, posing the question, and showing how one character grapples with it.
As we've talked about the book just before, you know, just casually, you've made pointedly clear to me that you see this, while it is obviously, you know, so much, you know, at the center of the narrative is this Armenian American history and all this experience, but that this is an American novel. This is a novel about the American experience. And so in that way, can you elaborate on that a little bit? And, you know, because I'm not sure that would be so self-evident to everyone. And in that context, too, how maybe you see this novel fitting into kind of the American literary, you know, landscape. Where does it fit?
I think it's easy enough to pigeonhole. I remember when Bloodvine came out, a reviewer for the San Francisco Chronicle said, you know, this fits squarely within ethnic literature. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, what American literature isn't ethnic literature? I mean, really? I mean, what are we going to write about? But this is one of the sad consequences of a kind of pinheaded academic and critical world. You know, even American Indian literature is ethnic literature. I mean, how is that possible? If that isn't American literature, what is? So, Italian Americans, Jewish Americans, you know, Vietnamese Americans, Chinese Americans, everything we write becomes ethnicized. I think this points more to it shows with the makeup of the people who write about it that way than it says anything about America. Because America is and will continue to be, for as long as any of us probably will be here, about people coming over with the past and somehow forging a new place and identity here. And that experience is the American experience. And to put it aside as ethnic really completely misses the mark. So that's why I think it is a purely American book. Because it's about becoming American. It's not about being American. We have plenty of books that talk about being American and about the frustration of being American, about the exhaustion with being American. That's mostly contemporary literature, in the turn to one or another kind of decadence as a consequence of the exhaustion of being American. But we don't have many books that talk about becoming American. And that really is, I think, the American story. And that's where I like to see River Big and Bloodvine, you know, placed in that light.
That's great. One of my favorite passages in the book is where the cultures of kind of old Armenia and that of California's Native Americans, the American Indian community, collide. And you tell the story here of Tulare Lake, which, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, was once, you know, say from Mount Whitney, the most dominant feature on the California map. This is a huge body of water that sat between basically Bakersfield and Fresno, and was drained at the turn of the 20th century, literally drained, sucked dry by giant agribusiness interests to turn all that lake bed into, you know, mostly cotton and wheat fields and then cotton fields. But when it was a lake, this giant lake, four times the size of Lake Tahoe, it was home to four distinct tribes of Yokut Indians. And there's this great scene, again, it's where Yervant, Andy's father, first learns about the Yokuts in this. I think it's just incredibly wonderful. And then he decides to go out and visit this ancient, you know, lake bottom to see what this is all about. So why don't you read as a last passage, and then we'll open it up to your questions and let you hear what you want to ask Eris.
By the way, I owe almost all the research for this, which was, you know, which I was pretty stupid about, was from Rick and Mark's book, King of California.
That's why I liked it so much.
Yeah. But that's, you know, how, you know, so we're kind of like, you know, borrowing from and stealing from one another. So the information was largely drawn from that book. Yervant had gotten in his mind to head out that way a few weeks before after attending a lecture at the Aspares Club. On Saturdays, farmers would drive in from the country to spend a few hours with their compatriots in the city at that downtown club, a single room and kitchen dimly lit with small wooden tables and around them fold-out chairs. There was a rack for Armenian dailies, a wall closet full with games. In twos and threes, men would sit and slurp thick Turkish coffee or sip a water pipe. Between the flick of cars and the click of the wooden discs, men would parse the news of the day or openly admit their fate. Scholarly books in Armenian were scarce in Fresno, but a handful of men were proficient in the Armenian or European languages and possessed tomes in those tongues that told of recent scientific and philosophical trends. As a result, nearly every Saturday afternoon, the club would become a makeshift lecture hall where these men would speak on everything from Einstein's mind-blowing discoveries to the genesis of the whooping cough to the pessimisms of Spengler. It was there one fall afternoon that Yervant heard Peter Minassian, an attorney by trade, tell them the history of the place where they had in fact arrived. What is it made of? Who lived here before us? With a stack of books on the table in front of him, he told of what was once an inland sea called Tuleri. This 800-square-mile wonder had great stretches of wetlands where swans and billy owls nested, and mile after mile that teemed with wildflower and vernal pools. Elk, antelope, and deer came to cool down there and drink. He had them picture massive migrations of geese from Canada in winter, the atmosphere thrumming like a tornado from millions of wings all flapping at once. Yervant sat transfixed, and Minassian had just begun. He told them next of the natives, Indians called Yokuts, who lived there among the tall reeds, like the marsh Arabs where the Tigris and Euphrates meet, and how they fished the shallows with their hands or with a single sweep of their nets raised hundreds of trout and bass. In winter, the canoes, he claimed, were fashioned to cut through the foggy shallows like spoon through yogurt. How many of them live there? This was hard to know. Thousands, it is thought, and for thousands of years, and happy with their lot. Of a single piece with the earth, until they were ripped from it by disease, starvation, or murder. By whom? He asked, and from the rapt audience paused for an answer. Who could blame half a dozen men for wondering if the perpetrators were Turks, even if they were half a world away? Catholics, he answered. There was a chorus of course. The Crusaders had done the same to them in 1204. Then Yervant Stuck shook his head at the magnitude of these Yokuts' loss, asked of the remnants. Where had they escaped? Chiga, Minassian said. There are no more. And he dusted his hands. Not a single man could contradict. They'd been in the valley for some 20-odd years, and none of them had met a Yokut yet. Yervant asked, Pites, Hech Chiga, but there are none? Scattered here and there, perhaps, like sterile seeds. That evening, Levon Simonian, Aram Topalian, and Yervant gathered at the house. The men took chairs on the front porch and continued over a bottle of rakı, the conversation marveling at the ravenous and Eden-like scenes Minassian had rendered. It was after harvest late in the summer, and the ground was dry and the air hot and mostly motionless. Every now and then, they would pause to savor the rakı's warmth in a cool breeze that shambled by. When the sun died, Calypso brought out plates of cheese and bread and sliced meat and green onions, and they folded it all into little packets and ate. Soon the moon appeared fresh as lately fallen snow. From its case, Levon lifted his fat-bellied oud and began singing a quavering call. It was Turkish music, and though it was taboo, they sung all of them for the first time in many years in the Turkish tongue. Then Yervant got up and began dancing by himself or with a spirit that Rahi might have conjured. And down the steps he went to an open patch of dirt, and in circles he turned. Then he stopped and announced, "You know, there was on this land a Med Yeren, a great cataclysm, as the survivors called the genocide. We sit here and we eat and drink. We have found solace here. But let us not forget that we walk and sleep and work on the bones of Yokuts."
That's fantastic. Wow. Yeah, I think we've all got one story in some sense. It just keeps repeating itself. It's amazing. Love to open it up to you. And I think, as Luis said, there's a handheld mic, right? That if anyone has any thoughts, questions for Eris, please, now's your moment.
I'll start. Eris, the book, in the beginning, there's also this wonderful relationship, interesting relationship between the Japanese-American farmer and the and your main character, the older. Could you talk about that? I mean, was that uncommon? Were those kinds of guardianships of Japanese-American farms going off to the camps common in the valley?
Well, as part of the American story, the book begins with two farmers, one Japanese, one Armenian, both having immigrated to America. And they are, it's kind of the prelude to the book. And one's Takahashi, the other's Chimichin. And Takahashi is just setting off for the concentration camps. They have rounded them up, made the call, and all the Japanese farmers, though there were plenty of them in the valley, need to do something with their land. So there were Armenian farmers. This is based on a real case who stepped in to take care of. Sometimes no one stepped in. Other times they stepped in, but stepped in very poorly, and the thing went to pot. But Chimichin was a very fastidious man, very fastidious farmer, and he ended up farming Takahashi's land better than he would his own, causing his wife great distress and jealousy. This story, just really quickly, I worked in cherries for a long time, coordinating the harvest of cherries, and one of the cherries farmers was a Japanese man. And cherries are very hard to pick. You know, they cost a lot of money, not because they cost so much to grow, but they cost so much to harvest. They literally have to be picked one by one like this and put into little baskets. There's no mechanical way of doing it because they bruise so easily. So this one Japanese farmer whose orchard we harvest, every harvest, he would have, you know, this Armenian farmer, who was a very large farmer, would bring his crews over. And the Armenian guy would overlook the harvest. And the Japanese guy just sat on the edge of the field. And I couldn't figure it out. 1 year passed, 2 years passed. The Armenian guy is looking over, looking, inspecting the fruit. It's his labor. It's his people. And finally, I asked one of the old guys there, kind of the farm manager of the Armenian, "What the hell's going on here?" And he said, "Well, here's the story. Takahashi's dad, when he went off to the camp, he left his farm in the care of this farmer, this Armenian farmer. I won't name his name. And ever since then, when they harvest these trees, he steps in. Now they're both dead. Now the kids have stepped in, and they harvest it." And so I thought, how strange and unlikely this is. And the Japanese guy just sat back and let it all happen. It was his equipment. It was tens of thousands of dollars. But he felt
as a family tradition, they felt the need to do it just like they had done it, to bring it back to life once a year for this harvest of these particular trees. Wow.
Incredible. I think, yeah, in the middle there. Thanks.
Oh, here?
Yeah, right there. Yeah. Yeah, there you go.
Thank you for doing this. This is wonderful. I had the particular pleasure of attending the, I think it was also called Aloud, or maybe not, in the Glendale Library about, what, a month ago? Whatever it was, anyway. when Arisan and Mark spoke together, and my friend and I, we bought three books, Bloodvine and River Big, and In My Father's Name. And I spent all my late nights and early mornings finishing off, I can't remember what came first, I think Bloodvine and then River Big. And then I have like 3 pages left here on this book. And it's totally fascinating to me. I spent some time in Fresno in the late 70s, well, mid 70s, and not farming, but doing actually Chicano theater. And it was an amazing experience, very hot and very cold and very foggy. But so I had, I was inspired to think to myself about the way stories are told by reading these three books. I felt that you, Eris, are more of a poet than your cousin Mark, who's very much of a journalist. And both have great merit. I don't want to say which is my favorite, but, you know.
Go ahead.
Yeah. But no, I think that your way of writing is just is so generous and so engaging. And at the same time, I really hesitate to use this word, but I think it really describes it, in some ways sort of mystical. And yet being exactly like with your hands and your toes in the earth. And I just wanted to say, I love your use of and like invention of verbs and adjectives and metaphors. I think that they just were so beautiful, so incredibly beautiful. So I really enjoyed that a lot. And the Asperaz, is that how you say it? Asperaz Club? That was a great little gift, I think, you know, to put in that story. I mean, the story of the Yukats was wonderful, but even just the Asperaz Club, because to show these men who came from this place who are really hard living men, and they come together and they enjoy this intellectual and like I think Rick was saying, or you were saying, or both were saying, about how there's more to these people than you ever know. Yeah, I do. I can't remember what it was. Ah, okay, so when's your next book?
Well, that's a fair question. Thank you so much. That was very sweet, by the way. Very sweet. You know, it's funny that you use the word mystical, because I do feel sometimes that there is a strain of that running beneath the writing. I do feel that. I'm not saying, you know, that I'm blessed by God and somehow. You know, it's not that. It's that, it's more that there's an underlying energy, you know, that I think I'm trying to tap into in the writing. And part of it's a cultural energy. Part of it is the deep history of the Armenian people that I'm trying to draw out through language.
It's all those ghosts. I mean, seriously,
yes,
that's
it is,
real.
It
that's
is
real,
maybe the ghosts.
That's real stuff.
So that could be it. But there's also, yeah. My next book is going to flatten everybody. I've gone from farming to writing about the LA riots. And I'm writing a first-person, not personal, but it's a first-person narrative about a Lebanese-Armenian kid in the middle of the riots, who wakes up, doesn't wake up one day, but watches the 92 riots unfolding, and it's against the backdrop of his family and his life here in L.A.
Wow, nice. I didn't know that. Nice.
Wonderful, and you excited me about the book. In the Western Armenian literary tradition, we have a very rich rural literary tradition, which was sort of which disappeared except in memory side in the generation that survived the genocide.
Yes.
And then one of the impacts of the genocide was that basically Armenian life became urbanized, except in a couple of pockets.
Yes.
And Fresno was, and the valley was one of that. And then we had a couple of villages in Syria, Lebanon. Now, in Lebanon, Anjar was where some of that rural Armenian tradition by Edvard Boyajian, Sanabian, and others have developed. But it's amazing that that generation of your father, grandfather, did not produce any major literary works in Armenian, in Fresno, and I mean in this rural, sort of surviving rural environment. And then it's great to hear that you're bringing that up in English now, and hopefully that will be translated into Armenian and will become part of our Western Armenian tradition.
I hope so.
Interesting. Yeah, in the back there's a hand, and then come to the front.
Hi, I haven't read your book, or so I'm sorry if this question might not be exactly addressing some of the themes and issues that are in there, but it seems that there's in your book there's a tension between place, history, identity, and concepts of ownership. And ownership of land is tied into narratives in which characters invest themselves in their own subjectivity. And in what parts of your book, I'm very curious, are these narratives short-circuited? Maybe you mentioned that the brothers have to get a government loan to buy the land. So they don't really own the land. So the narratives change.
They own land, but then they get a loan to farm another piece of land.
Oh, okay. So are any of these narratives short-circuited, these narratives that constitute their subjectivity and their individual identities, or are their identities sort of stable throughout the throughout the novel?
I'm not sure I completely understand the question, but I'll try to answer as I understand it. The relationship to land is, you know, obviously farmers have this. All farmers do. But we all do, you know, even if we're not farmers. We have a relationship to a place, even if it's our own front yard or even if it's, you know, our own home. And so, you know, the Armenians having been ripped, violently ripped from their own homeland becomes something which they are short. You talk about a short circuit. This is a vast short circuit. I mean, for those people who don't know, it wasn't that the Armenians were just, you know, killed. It's that the places they had lived and farmed and created cultures and generated their world was taken from them. And everything was left behind. So that short-circuiting kind of reverberates and mirrors in the novel quite a lot. But I think it's one of the ways of dramatically putting this is when someone is kicked off their land. I mean, we have that. We use that. You know, he's kicked off his land. You know, none of us, very few of us are rural anymore. I mean, we don't experience that. But we continue to experience this sense of being displaced from what grounds us. And so I think the novel is largely about being displaced and trying to find a seed, a place to plant oneself and begin new. And that place is America. And even for people born in America, that process has not always happened. Andy was born in America, but he still is struggling. Maybe the seed is there, but he's still struggling to bring it up.
So, Lisa, we have one more maybe in the... Okay, a couple more. Okay, so in the front here is... Yes. Uh-huh.
It's very powerful writing, Eris. I can't wait to read this sequel. I want to go back to the Armenian literary tradition with specific respect to Fresno. What do you think your difference is generationally in your relationship with William Saroyan in your treatment of the Armenian community and the history of Armenians and the Holocaust?
That's a really important question. Saroyan, of course, is the greatest Armenian American writer we have, one of the great, I think, writers of the 20th century, though not very widely read anymore. He is really one of the great natural, along with like Hemingway, Fitzgerald writers that we've ever had. I think that Saroyan. His temperament was different than mine. I mean, I just really have to answer it that way. His temperament, the way he approached things, was the Armenian became the color and the flavor for his writing. And that color, the way he brought that color and flavor alive was so appealing, so tasty, that people just gobbled it up. That's in his major works. But if you read deeper into his, autobiographical work or his diary entries, you see the guy knew what was going on. He was not naive about the Armenian-American experience. I mean, the Armenian experience. I think removed now, he was born here, but my father was, so I'm one generation removed and integrated into America. I think that there's more of a, drawing back and looking at the sweep of history more, that allows me a little bit bigger perspective on how this has all affected us and what this means in the context of the rest of America, rather than just the flavor of this culture landed out of nowhere into nowhere. It's about where this culture, how this culture reflects the entire American experience. And so, that's my just quick answer. Maybe it's not a very thoughtful answer, but yeah. So that's my take on Aram Saroyan's here tonight. He's Bill's son. And we've had conversations about it actually quite a lot. And I'm not sure he even really understands it, we've had conversations about what the, because the parallel is natural to draw, but that's the best I can put it.
Yeah.
Why did you decide on your first book to write about Andy?
This is my daughter speaking. Well, the answer is very simple, sweetie. I love my daddy. And he had a story to tell, but he couldn't tell it. So I told it for him.
Okay.
Yeah. Equal time.
My question is, when a character dies in one of your stories, or example, when they're really happy, what do you feel when Well, do you feel the emotion when he or she dies, even though another character is also playing you, so you're playing both characters?
That's my daughter. Well, when you write about anything, whether it's happiness, sadness, you know, a wedding or a funeral, you have to imagine with all your might that you are there. And you cannot turn your eyes away or flinch because it hurts or because it's too happy. Because we turn our eyes away sometimes from both. So my job, a writer's job, is to look at it and try to tell it exactly the way they feel it and see it. Regardless of how I feel about it, it's not important how I feel about it. It's important how the person who's experiencing feels about it. And I have to tell that story.
That's great. Eris, thank you so much. Really just wonderful. Eris will be signing books outside.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.